Pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, we'll finish reading from Journal of a Tour to North Carolina by William Atmore, 1787, published by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1922. Greenville, so called in honor of General Greene, is the county town of Pitt County. It is situated on the southeast side of Tar River, at this place about 90 or 100 yards over, when the river is low, though near a mile wide when there are freshes in the river, and it is here about 10 feet deep. The village consists of about 15 families, and is a place of some trade, the planters in the vicinity bringing their produce to this landing. The town stands high and pleasant. Mr. Jones and I, after eating our breakfasts, walked to Messrs. Easton and Wright's store at the bank of the river. With the latter, I had some business. The former was my fellow passenger. Mr. Easton invited us to drink some punch with him before we continued our journey. This we did, not because we wanted any, but it is a maxim with me in general not to reject the preferred civilities of any man. We walked up to his lodgings, where I saw his daughter, little Sylvia, my fellow passenger from Philadelphia. Just as we were about to set off from Greenville, it began raining, and appeared likely to continue to rain the whole day. We had our horses led to the stable again, and after waiting 2 or 3 hours, appearances being more favorable, we crossed to the north side of the river in a small scow, and pursued our way. We rode about 10 miles to the house of William Teuton, and were informed there that he was gone to Tarboro, and was not expected home for several days. This determined me to accompany Mr. Jones to that place. We accordingly rode on 5 miles further, and about nightfall arrived at the house of Mrs. Cobb, an ancient woman, who keeps a petty ordinary. We concluded to stay here all night, not being sure of obtaining a lodging in Tarboro if we went there, as we had heard that every house was crowded, the assembly being then met at that place. Mrs. Cobb's house consisted of 2 apartments. One was the sitting room. The floor was clay or dirt, and there was 1 bed in the room. The other apartment was floored with boards, and contained 4 good beds, 2 on each side of the room. Mrs. Cobb is a woman between 83 and 84 years of age, as she told me. She was born in the Isle of Wight County, Virginia. She retains her faculties, and is as brisk and lively as most women of 30 years of age. She waits on travelers herself, and even goes to the stable and takes care of their horses herself. This is not from necessity, having assistance enough if she chooses it, but seems to plume herself on her activity, and attention to her guests and to their horses. This woman has near 50 descendants, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. We complained on entering the house that the fire was almost out. She went and brought a load of wood, threw it on, and with a pleasant air said, "There it will be a fire when it burns," alluding, I suppose, to the story of the fox that made the ice smoke. We were furnished with a very indifferent supper, but our horses being well taken care of in regard to food, and each one being fastened by himself in a covered log pen, we, getting clean and good beds for ourselves, were not uneasy. Mr. Van Norden and another gentleman arrived in the course of the evening. At this stage we were now 4 guests, but we got each of us a bed to ourselves. Thursday, December 20. We were alarmed in our quarters before day by the firing of muskets at some little distance from the house in which we lay. We found that the firing was at a schoolhouse in the neighborhood of our quarters, with powder only. 'Tis the custom here for schoolboys, upon the approach of Christmas, Easter, and Whitsuntide, to rebel against their schoolmaster, in order to force him to grant them a holiday. The boys rise early in the morning and go to the schoolhouse, which is considered as their fort. They barricade the doors and windows, carry into the house with them victuals and blankets, with water and wood sufficient to sustain the siege that they expect from the master. Upon his approach, at the usual school hours, he finds himself shut out. He demands the cause. The garrison acquaints him that they are determined to have a holiday. This is frequently denied, and now commences the siege. The master tries to force his way into the house. They resist him by every means in their power, and sometimes give him some very serious hard knocks, throw stones, etc. It is generally looked upon as a piece of fun. The master pretends to be solicitous to subdue them, and if he catches any straggler from the fort, he will flog him heartily. And it is understood on these occasions that the boys are to be peaceable, except during the actual storm of the enemy, when they are at liberty to maul him to their heart's content. This scene is sometimes continued many days. At last the master proposes terms, that he grants them so many days' holiday, which, if satisfactory, being accepted by the garrison, peace is again established in the little community. Sometimes, however, the master, not being a good-humored man, and not entering into their views, finds means to subdue the garrison, and threshes the ringleaders heartily. Jones and I set out about sunrise from Mrs. Cobb's, and rode 11 miles to Tarboro before breakfast, riding over a bridge built of wood at the town over Tar River. Tarboro is the county town of Edgecombe County. It is situated on the southeast side of Tar River. At this place, about 80 yards over, the town contains about 20 families, and for the size of it has a considerable trade. It is the highest town on the river, and boats seldom go above this place. The houses are all of wood. It is situated on a high, flat piece of ground, and is a very pleasant place. We found upon our arrival at Tarboro the place much crowded, the legislature being sitting for the dispatch of business. The size of the town appeared so inadequate to the comfortable accommodation of a legislature composed of about 120 commons, or delegates, and about 60 senators, together with the people attending the sessions in business, or going there on motives of pleasure, that you will not easily believe that it was possible to provide for them. Yet, provided for they were, and they said themselves, very comfortably. One old countryman said that he had cause to be satisfied that he lived there much better than at home. Captain Toole, a trader, and for the time innkeeper, provided for 40 or 50 members, with a great number of others. Every family, almost, received some of the members. Beds were borrowed from the country, 3 or 4 placed in a room, and 2 of their honors in a bed. Provisions were in plenty. Horses were mostly sent to farms in the vicinity of the town. Mr. Faulkner, who formerly resided sometime in Philadelphia, brought hither his E.O. table. Gambling was carried to great extent, at this table and also at other games. At times, several of my acquaintances have told me of their losses. A trader of Newbern lost in one night £600. Some attempts were made to present some dramatic pieces, but with very bad success. 2 of the actresses were adventuresses from Charleston. I rode up to the house of Captain Toole, situated at a corner of 2 streets. In the middle of the street that crosses by the side of his house, there was a place for horses to stand, composed of 2 posts set in the ground at about 15 feet distance from each other. On the tops rested a cross-piece, with pins at intervals for fastening the bridles. Here stood 12 horses, and here I fixed mine with the rest, till I should be able to get a place for him. Going into the front room, I found the table laid for breakfast in 2 rows. I waited some time by the fireside. When the breakfast being brought in, I hung up my hat, and without any ceremony took my seat amongst the crowd. Legislators, planters, and merchants. After being all seated, I lifted up my eyes and saw that I had committed a faux pas. Every man but me had kept his hat on. However, this made but little difference. I only determined to keep it on next time. We had a tolerable breakfast. My friend Jones had gone to breakfast with an acquaintance. I found Mr. Thomas Stewart here, whom I had seen at Newbern. He kindly offered to show me the way to the courthouse where the assembly sat. Having accepted his offer, we walked up. The courthouse is a large wooden building of 2 apartments, and standing on brick pillars. In the long room, the commons met. In the other, the Senate. Any person is at liberty to go and hear the debates of either house, standing uncovered without their bar. The bar at the Senate was a board laid across 2 old trunks, standing on the ends, which served very well pro tem. The bar of the commons house was the courtroom bar. Every member sat with his hat on, except when addressing the chair. The business before the house not being very interesting, I soon retired. But soon after hearing that the new governor was to be sworn into office, I returned. There was now a joint meeting of the two houses in the large room. A committee of three or four gentlemen went to him. They walked together to the house. All the members rose on his entering, the usual oath of allegiance to the state and oath of office as governor being by him distinctly repeated and sworn. He retired to his lodgings, there being no ceremony of proclamation. Retiring from thence, I soon after met my fellow passenger Mackey. Taking a walk with him, we called at Mr. Clement's store. I was introduced to him. Next, I took a walk to the house of my friend Richard Blackledge. He was at home and introduced me to his wife, an elegant woman, to Miss Brannan, and to Miss Hill, who were at his house. He invited me to dine. Leaving Blackledge, I was introduced to Mr. Ross, a merchant. At dinner, I returned to Richard Blackledge's. Here was a large company, amongst others Judge Williams. I was introduced to some of the company, and during dinner an argument arose between one of the gentlemen present and the judge, respecting slaves. The judge wished that there was an immediate addition of 100,000 slaves to the state. I soon became a party, and we had a good deal of conversation on the subject. I principally endeavored to shew the political inexpedience of the practice of keeping slaves, by argument on the advantages a state having none but free citizens must have over a state encumbered with slaves in case of a contest for power, and by shewing the disadvantages to posterity from the practice. With just glancing a few hints on the general rights of mankind, such as I thought that my auditory might bear, the judge frankly declared that his views were for the present ease and affluence, and said that he admitted our great-grandchildren would be slaves. Here seemed to rest our argument. I now took a walk. Afterwards, Mr. Jones coming to look for me, I returned to tea in the evening. Dr. Williamson was there, to whom I was introduced. After some conversation, I took a walk up to Toole's. Here I saw my fellow passenger Billy Ford. He had a black eye and wore a silk handkerchief tied over it. Upon inquiry into the cause of this disaster, he informed me that there had been, an evening or two before, a jovial meeting of some of the members of the legislature in the courthouse, when he, standing up to entertain them with the exhibition of Bucks Have At Ye All, some of the company grew riotous. Somebody threw an orange skin and hit him in the eye. Somebody also threw the leg of a turkey, which missed him, but fell not guiltless to the floor, giving Toole a violent blow on the back. He invited me to go upstairs to be introduced to some great men, but I was engaged. Soon after parting with Ford, my attention was engaged by a quarrel in one of the rooms below. A stout man in liquor, wanting to fight with another man not so disposed. He endeavored all in his power, by opprobrious words, and otherwise, to provoke the quiet man to strike him first, in order to avoid being indicted for an assault, and, as the phrase is here, to quit the law. Amongst other expedients, he lay down on the floor, upon his back with his legs and arms extended, calling, "Now strike me! Kick me! Stamp upon me!" But his adversary was not to be provoked to give him an opportunity to make battle with impunity. After taking a drink of porter with my friend John Whittall at Toole's, tired with the different scenes of the day, I began to think of a bed. I had asked if Mackey to let me have a part of his bed in the store. I went there. He told me I could be accommodated with a spare bed in the house, and going out, Mr. Gilchrist, his brother's partner, came in and invited me into the house. Here he introduced me to Samuel Johnson, Esquire, the new governor, to General McDowell, and other gentlemen. Colonel Davy was here, to whom I was introduced at Newbern. The governor and I had a long conversation on various topics, and I retired to bed pretty late. Friday, December 21st. I breakfasted at Captain Toole's. Afterwards I saw William Ford, who invited me to dine with him. This did not suit today. He invited me to call in the forenoon and take a glass of wine with him. This I did. Having this morning seen Mr. Gilchrist, he told me that he had expected me to breakfast. He invited me to dine with him, and desired that David Jones would come also. I took a walk to the tobacco inspection. The price of that article is 50 per £100 part to be paid in goods. David Jones and I went to dine at Mr. Gilchrist's. After dinner, the governor came in. Most of the company, except him, retiring, he and I had a long tête-à-tête conversation. He kindly invited me to pay him a visit if I should come in the neighborhood of Edenton, where he resides, which I promised. In the evening I went to visit William Tooton at Mr. Greer's. Here was Benjamin Brown and William Ford. In the evening I walked to Richard Blackledge's, where I took tea, then returned to Mr. Greer's, where I eat supper. Two back-country assemblymen came in, one named Gardner from Surrey County. We had a long conversation on the subject of paper money. One of the assemblymen seemed to think merchants of little benefit to the country, and said that he wished there were none for 100 years to come. It growing late, we could not end our subject, but the assemblymen said that next evening they were at our service for further debate. I stayed and slept with Benjamin Brown. Saturday, December 22nd. I breakfasted and dined at Toole's. There was snow, sleet, and rain all day. They were out of wood at Toole's, and we suffered there for want of fire. In the evening I saw Mr. Gilchrist. He invited me to lodge at his house, letting me know that he expected me last night. I drank chocolate there. The governor was there, and I had another long tête-à-tête conversation the early part of the evening with him on the slavery of the Negroes, on liberty, and about many of our acquaintances, their houses, etc. General McDowell afterwards came in. We had a good deal of conversation. He told us about his wars with the English, the Indians, and the bears. He was one of those commanders who defeated and killed Colonel Ferguson at King's Mountain. He is an elderly man. His locks are beginning to silver over. General McDowell related his killing some bears nearly as follows. There was a large old tree with a hole in it, very high up. Some of us went there, and we thought it was likely there was a bear down that hole. I got an Indian ladder. This is a sapling with the limbs cut off about a foot from the stock so as to take hold with the hands and feet in climbing. This ladder I set up against the tree, and getting a long pole with a flaming brand on the end, I got up the ladder, with the pole, and held the fire to the hole in the tree, which soon took fire. The smoke and heat forced out a full-grown bear, who descended so fast I was at last obliged to drop myself to the ground. Here I had left my gun, and, just as the bear was reaching the ground, I fired and broke his back. We then dispatched him with the axe. Soon after, another bear, called a yearling, came out and descended. We knocked him on the head also with the axe. And there came out of the hole one more bear, also a yearling. He ran out upon the boughs of the tree. And there being a bad marksman in the company, we set him to shoot this bear. After firing many times, he at last hit him and brought him down. As I grew very sleepy, I retired to bed. This evening, the assembly finished their session and broke up. Sunday, December 23rd. It is very much the custom in North Carolina to drink drams of some kind or other before breakfast, sometimes gin, cherry bounce, eggnog, etc. Several of the assemblymen this morning indulged themselves in this respect. The assemblymen pushed out of town this forenoon in great numbers, many of them appearing very anxious to get home. Monday, December 24. I breakfasted at Mr. Gilchrist's today and dined at Captain Toole's. I visited William Tooten upon business. He offers payment in lands for a demand that we have. Could not agree about the terms. The Assembly of North Carolina consists of two commons and one senator for each county in the state. Of these counties, there are about 60. The legislature meet the first Monday in November by law. Some of them came to the Assembly to Tarboro 800 miles. These came from the settlements about Cumberland River. These members encamp in the woods, returning home part of the way. The country is settled as far back as 300 or 400 miles. In the evening I rode out to Edward Hall's farm, about 2 miles from Tarboro, upon business. He inviting me to stay all night, I accepted his invitation. The evening, moonlight, and it's been a fine day. Tuesday, December 25th. This morning, according to North Carolina custom, we had before breakfast a drink of eggnog. This compound is made in the following manner. In 2 clean quart bowls were divided the yolks and whites of 5 eggs. The yolks and whites separated. The yolks beat up with a spoon and mixed up with brown sugar. The whites were whisked into froth by a straw whisk till the straw would stand upright in it. When duly beat, the yolks were put to the froth. Again beat a long time. Then 1/2 pint of rum poured slowly into the mixture. The whole kept stirring the whole time, till well incorporated. After breakfasting, I returned to Tarboro. I dined with Andrew Greer. After dinner, saw a dance of Negroes to the banjo in his yard. In the afternoon, I set off for Washington. After riding a few miles, I overtook Brown, Teuton, and Company, who were going down the road. We stopped at Mrs. Cobb's, took a drink, and rode to Jones Tavern, being some in the night. We arrived in the height of a quarrel there between two men. The landlady applied to me to part them. I told her, no, let them settle their own differences. They were going to fight out in the road, when one of the company declared he would massacre the man who should attempt to gouge, that is, endeavors to run his thumbs into the eyes of the other and scoop out his eyeballs. Womble, one of the disputants, declared, I cannot fight without a gouge. One of the company supported his declaration, saying, Aye, a gouge all weathers, by God. The terms were not accepted. Their passions cooled by degrees, and the gouging man said, Though I am but a little shoemaker, I won't be imposed upon. I replied, You may be a shoemaker, perhaps, but you are. And a page of the manuscript is missing here. Which is a shame. I would like to know how that story finished. So we resume. In some places on the way, there appears amongst the trees a very luxuriant herbage, one sort called reed, appearing like our meadow tussocks, as we call them, is now green and continues so all winter, and another kind, which now looks brown, like dead grass, but grows green toward spring. Both are excellent for cattle. The settlements along this road are but few. I was overtaken in the woods by a man in a homespun jacket and ragged trousers, mounted on a pony a little bigger than a goat. The first notice I had of him was by his giving a whistle behind me. I grasped a loaded whip, and, turning it in my hand, looking round me, with some little apprehension from the loneliness of the place, he came up, and rode about 2 or 3 miles with me when he left me. I found by his conversation that he was a tar-burner. We had a variety of chat. Amongst other talk, he told me that 2 wolves had been killed about a fortnight before near the place we were then. After parting with this honest fellow, I rode on, trusting my horse to choose the road, and his choice did credit to his sagacity, except once where there happened to be a post of direction. Here he seemed to incline to go contrary to the direction on the post, which conduct I could not account for, as it was clear he was not making homeward, till afterwards, upon inquiry, I found his owner had been used to ride up that road while courting the lady, now his wife, and that place was still the habitation of some agreeable young ladies. Perhaps his intention was to introduce me there. After riding 25 miles, I arrived at Mr. Pierce's, where I got dinner and rested my horse. There was playing at his door 5 negro children, every one dressed in a shirt only. Clothes are not bestowed on these creatures with much profusion. At Johnson's, one was walking about the courtyard absolutely naked, and in Newbern I saw a boy through the street with only a jacket on, and that unbuttoned. From Pierce's I rode 5 miles to Mr. Blunt's ferry at Tar River. Here 2 negroes rowed me over to the Washington shore, where I landed at sunset. Being fond of remarking upon the tempers of men and upon human nature in general, under every appearance and circumstance I thought proper to interrogate Polydore, one of the negroes who rowed me, in respect to his condition, as follows. Atmore, where was you born, boy? Polydore, I was born in Guinea. Atmore, don't you want to go back to your country? The other negro answers, he is fast, he can't go. Polydore, I have learnt another language now, they will kill me if I go back to my home. Atmore, how came you brought from your country? Polydore, I went with many more to attack a town, where they were too strong for us. They killed a great many, and took 140 of us prisoners, and sold us. Atmore, had you not better have let them alone, and remained in peace at home? Polydore, no, my nation always fight that nation. Atmore, and what would you do if you returned to your country now? Would you be quiet? Polydore, no, I go there and fight 'em worse than ever. As we got to shore at this period, I gave my 2 ragged ferrymen a small present, for which they were thankful, and galloped up the shore to my former quarters at Blackledge's. Here I found Miss Sally Salter and Miss Absalee Kennedy. The remainder of the manuscript has been lost, save the next page, a fragment descriptive of Newbern. Newbern is a town situated on a point or neck of land at the confluence of the rivers Neuse and Trent. Each of these rivers are at the town about 3/4 of a mile wide. The town contains about 500 or 600 houses, which are mostly built of wood. This place is generally reckoned to be the capital of North Carolina, though the legislature do not always meet there. There is an elegant house in this place called the Palace, formerly the residence of the governor. Many of the houses are large and commodious. Some are one story and some two stories high. There are to many of the houses balconies or piazzas in front and sometimes back of the house. This method of building is found convenient on account of the great summer heats here. These balconies are often two stories high. Sometimes one or both ends of it are boarded up and made into a room. There are convenient wharves at New Bern. These are mostly on the Trent side of the town, where the shipping generally lay. Vessels drawing 9 feet water can come up to the place. There is a small church here with a square tower, cupola, and bell, and it is the only place of worship in the town. Editor's note, this was the present Christ Church, New Bern, originally Craven Parish, established by the Vestry Act of 1715. The two royal governors, Tryon and Martin, attended this church during their occupancy of the palace. A very handsome silver communion service and alms basin, also Bible and prayer book, each bearing the royal arms, the silver engraved, presented by George II, King of England, are in the possession of the present Christ Church. The records of this parish were destroyed by fire many years ago, and the tradition to which the memory of man runneth not to the contrary is that these particular articles were presented to Christ Church by George II. However, Bishop Joseph Blunt Cheshire is inclined to the belief that this Eucharistic service, with accompanying prayer book and Bible, were originally given to the Royal Chapel of St. Philip's at Old Brunswick, and that when New Bern became the seat of the royal government under William Tryon, he transferred these sacred and beautiful articles to Christ Church, New Bern, and gave it the distinction of being the Royal Chapel. To the historian, this belief is quite tenable and only enhances the historic interest that clusters around this old parish. Back to Mr. Atmore's final note. This place being the county town of Craven County, there is a brick jail here, and a courthouse. The latter is raised on arches, the courts being held upstairs. The lower part serves for a marketplace, though but little provisions are carried there. People coming in boats or canoes sell their marketing at the riverside. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Carolina in the morning.